quite a bit to know from prophecy that probably would not be gleaned by just a casual reading of it. In fact, we'd probably be confused by a casual reading of prophecy. But I think also that you'll be able to see from what we said last night that prophecy has a real depth of insight and understanding that is attractive and that's inviting and also challenging. And as we continue, you're going to see, I think, that it's a real valuable study, and sometimes people wonder why I never got into it before. And I think probably if that is your case, you will enjoy very much what we learn and what we are able to delve into during this meeting. Several things I suppose I should say to start with, and I will later on as I continue in our studies bring these things up over and over again. And one question I often ask is, why didn't the Lord just say what he had in mind to say? Why did he put it in symbols? Now, if you haven't asked that, you probably wondered, because we have confusing ideas, it seems. We have clash of characters. We have all kind of symbols and suggestions in word pictures that really just don't make sense on the surface. And that, of course, is how it actually is. It doesn't seem to make sense unless we tie these things together. That's somewhat like a jigsaw puzzle. You buy a box and it says 1,000 pieces, and you dump it out on top of a card table, and you have a big pile of pieces, and where do you start? Well, you scratch your head, you scatter them out because you've got to get to the bottom of them, and you look and you look and look and probably find a corner or something that you can start on, put all the pieces together. It takes time. It takes a lot of doing. It takes a lot of working out. It takes a lot of trying and fitting, and it doesn't work. When you try to force a piece, later on you realize it was wrong. You have to come back and find how pieces fit in a logical way. And that's precisely what prophecy is. It's a matter of a lot of pieces that all fit, and they all fit perfectly where they're intended, and they don't fit anywhere else. Each piece fits exactly where it's intended to go, and if we put it in the wrong place or have the wrong understanding about it, we're going to come up with a distorted picture that's not what God intended. Why did the Lord do things this way? Why didn't he just say what he wanted? Many years ago in my start to say little daughter, she is little, but she's 26 years old. Back when she was about, 6 or 7, each night I'd go in and I'd get in the bed with her and we'd tell her a story. And quite often I would tell it in the King James language. And when I get to a certain point, she'd say, "What does that mean?" And I'd tell her. She said, "Well, why did you say so?" Point is, she didn't want me to talk in old English. She wanted me to tell her what it was in modern-day Southern American. And that's the way many people want the Bible to be. They want it to open up and just fall out in front of them. But that's not the best way. You see, on some of the things we're talking about, and you'll see this more and more as we continue our study, the things we're talking about have to do with events of world history written before they ever occurred. How would you like to know that you're going to die in 2 hours? Sort of chilling thought, isn't it? How about 2 days? How about 2 months? What would you do in the next 2 months? Well, you may have to prepare for that. Could happen. Probably it won't. But the fact is, we don't really know when we want to die. And the same thing's true about history. You see, if the world knew what was going to go on, it'd be a serious and a real problem to know things ahead of time. God doesn't tell us those things. And so the Bible does want us to know, but it wants us to know those things as it is proper for us to understand them. And so as the time develops where we should know these things, God lets us see those things. But they are in pictures until then. They are in symbolic language until then. And when the time comes for us to know what God wants us to know, and for him to let us know where we stand on the road to eternity, then he'll open up those symbols through an action of world history. And we say, "Oh, there's where we are." And we're going to be able to do that in our studies. We're going to be able to see exactly where we stand within the matter of just a few years in our study. The Lord has prepared for us to know those things, but they have been hidden. And we're living in a marvelous day in which we're going to be able to see backward almost everything the Bible talks about. Just a few things left. The Lord talks in symbols because this way he can state a truth. And later on, as that truth is revealed in world history, it not only shows us where we are, lets us understand God's wisdom and insight, and we thank him for it, but it also proves the Bible to be true because the Bible predicted these things decades, centuries, and sometimes thousands of years before they actually occurred. And when we can see prophecy way back yonder, telling us something was going to happen way up here, happens exactly that way, then we know. Whoever wrote it had to know what he's talking about. And of course, the author is God, and the penman is Daniel. We've come in our study up now through the prophets, through the visions and dreams of various kings who reigned in countries where Daniel happened to be living. First of all, he was taken captive, as you well know, from Jerusalem and the area around it into Babylon, and then it was taken over by the Persians, who were the next world power that came on the scene. And our study tonight is in chapter 7, which is a change in the direction, because now, rather than looking at the visions and dreams of the kings under whom Daniel served, we're now able to see Daniel's own visions and things God tells him to tell us. Now, one of the primary visions in the entire Bible is found in the second chapter. And quite a bit of what we're going to talk about, both here and in Revelation, is based upon the vision to Nebuchadnezzar. But now, Daniel fills in the gaps that we need to know about as we continue in chapter 7. So if you will, turn and read with me as we continue. In the first year of Belshazzar. Now, we remember from our study yesterday that that would be in 541, because he ruled as regent of a land under his father, the king. And this was to be the first of a four-year period in which he lived. And his reign and also his life came to an end 4 years later in 538. So we're talking about a time now that's right in the middle of the 6th century B.C. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head upon his bed. Then he wrote the dream and told the sum of the matters, and we're told the sum. Daniel spake and said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heaven strove upon the great sea. Now that's interesting, and the reason it's interesting is because we have here some word pictures, some symbols, which have some meaning that do not all of a sudden explain to us what he means just by the words alone. Let's see what we can understand about these matters. He said there were four winds of the heaven, and they strove upon a great sea. Now, he does not name a sea, and he does not tell us a great deal about the winds, but as in other places in the Old Testament writers were able to understand the many things we have discovered in our later days. Now, one of those is that the world was round. The Bible plainly tells us the world was in the shape of a sphere in the Old Testament. Job tells us, too, that the world is hung on nothing, so that we understand from that gravity. And even though Galileo and some of those early scientists, later from that point of view, but earlier from our point of view, were able to detect some of these ideas from their observations, the Bible speaks about it, in this particular case, as far back as 2000 B.C. 4,000 years ago, Job wrote about those things. He wrote about the empty place in the north and a number of other things we have recently discovered. Well, one thing we see in the writings of the Bible is that what it says sometimes has been misunderstood because we looked at it from the wrong point of view. You see, as of 400 or 500 years ago, when we would look at four winds or four corners of the earth or four somethings of this nature, we would think of a flat plane, like the table in front of us here. Because the concept of people in those days was that the world was flat. And if you go so far out to the edge of it, you would fall over and never come back again. They'd never been there and come back. Nobody really knew, but that was the idea of what would take place. And it made sense. Because as you look out over the prairie and the desert out here, you don't see any end to it. And you don't see a circle. What you see is relatively level, flat land with a few mountains here and there. But the overall picture looked like it's a plain with parts of the earth raised up. And so when the Bible speaks about the four corners of the earth, people thought in terms of a flat plain, which of course is absolutely wrong. Now when we talk about four winds too, all in the world we're talking about is directions, north, east, south, and west. And winds blow, and we of course know that they have to come from somewhere, and usually we talk about, well, the southeast wind, or the north wind, or whatever the case might be. All we're talking about is directions. So here we have encompassed in the wording here an all-surrounding view of the condition under which they lived. Another thing that we need to know about the place they lived and the understanding they had is that when you talk about the Great Sea, now he doesn't mention Great Sea here, but he mentions sea. And I want to say this at this point so we'll have a real good reason of understanding why in Daniel and Revelation. In fact, in most places of the Bible, we don't have some parts of the world recognized. Sometimes people say, well, now, are we mentioned in Revelation? Or what about China or Argentina or Australia? Are they mentioned in the Bible? And of course, people think in terms of the fact that if the Bible is worldwide in scope, it has to do with encompassing all peoples and all nations, then everybody ought to be mentioned. And of course, the everybody particularly is important when he talks about you. You know, where I'm living, am I mentioned there? Are my people mentioned there? What's going to happen to us? Everybody thinks in terms of their place, and they should. The sea spoken of in the Bible many, many, many times, most times in the case of prophecy, has to do with one thing, and that is multitudes of people. So a great sea refers to multitudes, and we're going to see that very clearly spoken and actually said in the book of Revelation. But the reason I want to mention about the sea is because there was one great prominent sea at that time. And the world as we know it was not known. In fact, the seven seas and the various other great bodies of water we know of today, in what at that time was an unknown part of the world, were there. But most people didn't know about it, because their world centered around a very, very large sea. In fact, they thought it was large. We know it's not. They thought it was a real large sea. Now, let me tell you what it was. Have you guessed already? Of course, the Mediterranean. What does that word mean, by the way? Well, of course, you see it. And it's a long word. And if you look on a map, it usually is a long word stretched across the whole sea. And that's precisely what you see on the map behind us here. And that's in the middle of the earth. Because the earth, as far as they were concerned, was Africa, the Middle East, and Europe. And they had heard some tales about people living way back over here in the East. They knew nothing beyond the Straits of Gibraltar. Absolutely nothing at that time. So as far as they're concerned, this was the world. That's all they knew about. This was a civilized world. The Mediterranean simply means, as the word itself would let us see, Medi, or the middle. Brother Leland, you've done a lot of building. Where are you? Somewhere back over here. Brother Sewell has, Brother Bill has, and several of you have done that. Have you ever put on a terracotta roof on a house or a building? Have you, Brother Sewell? Okay. What is terracotta? Okay. That's the whole thing in a nutshell. See, the word terra means earth or clay, as you said. Now, you've talked about that. You've ordered it for your buildings. You've had somebody put it on. Did you ever, and I like it, by the way. I think it's pretty. I think it's very doable. It's a long-lasting roof. But did you know it made from the earth? And that's what the word terra means. So notice, we have meta, terra, so there we have the middle of the earth. That's all in the world the word means. It means the middle of the earth. So the Mediterranean Sea, and what we're going to be talking about quite often in our studies, simply means the sea in the middle of the earth. And so everything centered around what they knew and what they were acquainted with at that time. That's the reason Australia is not important. That's the reason China or Iceland or Argentina is not important, because the primary civilization then centered around a large lake in the middle of the world. And this was their world. Now later on, we're going to see where we are involved. Yes, the United States is involved. I don't say it's mentioned by name. It's not. But we're involved, as well as England is involved, and Central Europe is involved. But basically, that's because of the extension of Christianity. So we're talking about an area of the world that leaves out many other places, because primarily it centers around the Middle East and where God's people are and were. And this is where most of the comments are made, because that's where most of the people were. And the primary thing of the entire Bible is to talk about God and His people and His work among His people. Now, verse 1 tells us that there were four winds. This talks about, of course, the directions. The entire specter of things are involved in every direction being pictured here by the four winds. And it strove upon a great sea, or multitudes of people. And four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse one from another. He begins to tell us now what these beasts look like. These beasts came up from the sea. Now, of course, let us understand that these beasts came up from the multitude of people on the earth, as he later on describes from us. So, naturally, you might understand that we're talking about four civilizations. So these four great beasts came up from the sea, the multitude of people, but they were different. They were not alike. They were separate and apart one from another. They were diverse one from another. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth and made stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it. Now, to put it in our own language, what he would say is simply this. This beast, this lion, this world empire was plucked. Now, if you were a chicken, you'd know what that meant. It meant you're incapacitated. And that's precisely what happened to him. He was plucked. But the point is, this is not a lion. This is a man. He tells us now it's a lion. Then he goes ahead and tells us, though, that a man's heart was in it. So here we have really a man pictured, or an empire ruled by a man. Now, this, of course, very simply, as you may well can understand, was Babylonia. Now, we've already seen this in chapter 2. All in the world he's doing in chapter 7 is simply repeating chapter 2 and expanding information about it. Now, you're going to find the same thing in chapter 8. As we go on, he's going to expand this picture, and the picture is going to get more vivid and more complete for us, and he's going to pinpoint details to the point at which we'll finally come up item by item, year by year, century by century, until we arrive at the New Testament era. So the book of Daniel really is nothing in the world but a map, just a map telling us where we're going as those people in those days were going toward God's church. The first of these empires, as we found in chapter 2, was Babylonia, and of course Nebuchadnezzar was the ruler of it. It goes on and says now in verse 5, another beast came on the scene, a second like to a bear, and it raised up itself on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of it, between the teeth of it, and they said thus unto it, arise, devour much flesh. Real interesting, and we will comment on that in just a moment. But the next beast, or the next empire that comes from the scene, and this ties in very clearly with chapter 2, is the next world empire that the Bible mentions. But if you completely leave the Bible out of it and go down to your library, you'll find the history books there beautifully picture the exact pattern of what the Bible gave and before it ever occurred. You see, history again wrote as to what the people observed when it occurred. The Bible tells us these things were going to happen before they ever happened, and history tells us that it happened just exactly like the Bible says. First kingdom was Babylonia. The next were the Medes and the Persians. This is pictured by the bear, and the significance of the three objects in his mouth. Verse 6 says, after this I beheld, and lo, another, like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. The beast had also four heads, and dominion was given to it. So we have another beast, another kingdom. We have Greece here, but Greece is pictured with different characteristics than was Medo-Persia or Babylon, either one. So we have three beasts symbolizing already three kingdoms we've spoken of. Now, verse 7 tells us of the fourth empire, but it tells us here something about it that we don't really have the knowledge to put our finger on right now, because he doesn't tell us that it's a squirrel or a rabbit or a sheep or a goat or a camel or a horse. He tells us here something descriptive rather than a name or title. After this, I saw in the night vision, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible. And that's all he says. Because you remember that in the second chapter, this was a picture of a great image of a man. But now, this fourth beast is dreadful and terrible. Doesn't say it was a man. Doesn't say it was a wild beast. Doesn't say it was a bird. He describes the condition of it. Dreadful and terrible. This might then very well tell you that we're about to talk about something that was so far superior to the others in the sense of might and power and dread and harm. And I might also add to that length of duration. Because this next beast that we're going to talk about actually had its beginning in 752 B.C. and lasted until 1452 A.D. Very, very long in scope, 2,100 years. So this dreadful and terrible empire, we're going to have to deal with the entire study of Daniel and Revelation. And that's what he's talking about here. He was strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth. He devoured and brake in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it. He was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, He begins now to tell us some things about it, which we won't talk about just now. Then he says that he beheld the thrones in verse 9. They were cast down. The Ancient of Days appears. Goes on ahead and talks to us in verse 10 about a fiery stream issuing, came forth from him, thousands and thousands ministered unto him, showing some great being that we have to do with. I beheld then, because of the voice of the great words which the horn spake, I beheld even till the beast was slain. This is the last beast we're talking about. Verse 11. The beast was slain, his body destroyed, and given to the burning flame. We're talking about this dreadful and terrible beast. Now, verse 12. As concerning the rest of the beast, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and time. It seems then to tell us here that we have a long span of time for this last beast, the dreadful and terrible beast, lasting really over 2,100 years, from its beginning till its end. Now, it was not prominent all that time. It was very obscure during a lot of that time, but the fact is, that's when it first began and when it ended, and we'll see that in Revelation. It doesn't tell us about it in Daniel. But then it says, the others before it, the three before it, they also had a time determined, but theirs was apparently very short compared to the dreadful and terrible one. Yet their lives were prolonged for a season and time, showing that it's a very limited duration. As we continue on, we have some more descriptive terms before we go into a detail of it. I saw in the night vision, behold, one like the Son of Heaven came to with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. There was given him dominion and glory and a nation and a kingdom, and all peoples, nations, languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed. Daniel was grieved because he was not able to understand these things. And of course, that's understandable, because Daniel, as far as I'm concerned, was at that time the closest man to God on the face of the earth. The Bible didn't say that in those words, but it does give indication that he was well-favored, and God says that time and time and time again, because Daniel served God, was humble before God, and glorified God in everything he did. I think, personally, that Daniel was given deeper and farther insight into the affairs of prophets than any other man who'd ever lived before him. John now comes on the scene in Revelation and has that same position. But the fact is, even Daniel and John, being inspired as they were and having the position before God which anybody would have enjoyed, even they did not see completely what they were writing about. Now, Daniel is grieved in his spirit, in the midst of my body, he says, and the visions of my head troubled me. I came near unto one of them that stood by and asked him the truth of all this. Tell me what it means. So he told me and made me know the interpretation of the things. These great beasts, which are four kings, which shall arise out of the earth. Now, of course, you see here the sea is the earth all of a sudden. They're not coming out of the real ocean. They're not water creatures. But he mentions the sea as multitudes of people we mentioned already. Now, they arise from the peoples of the earth, and they're four kings who rule in four kingdoms. But the saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. Now, verse 18 gives us assurance that we're going to find mentioned over and over again in other parts of Daniel and Revelation. And that simply is this. Of all those dreadful and horrible and terrible things we read about, of all those things we see here that make us cringe and shudder and wonder when that's going to be, don't worry about it. The reason why is because God says very plainly here, I'm going to take care of my people. Now, that doesn't mean that some of us will not be killed, because many Christians have in the past. It doesn't mean we're not going to experience some difficulties. We will. But the fact is, God lets us know that He is with us, He stands beside us, and no matter what we go through, He'll give us strength to endure if we'll only let Him do so. This simply assures us that God is standing with us and by us, and our end is going to be glorious if we allow God to lead us through all the difficulties. He's giving assurance here in verse 18. He does it time and time again. Then I would know, he says. He's already pretty well past his wonder about the first three, because that was relatively simple. But that dreadful and terrible beast, now that really struck his attention. Then I would know the truth of the fourth beast, which was diverse from all the others, exceeding dreadful, whose teeth were of iron, nails of brass, which devoured, break in pieces, and stamped the residue with his feet, and of the 10 horns that were in his head. Now the other which came up, and before whom 3 fell, even of that horn that had eyes and a mouth that spake very great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows. I think we'll stop there, for we want to, in just a moment, continue our thoughts. But before we do, we must go back now and see the foundation he has laid, lest we get too far ahead of what we need to understand before we actually go into this. He mentions here that we have a lion, a bear, and a leopard. The lion is representative, as we have already been told in chapter 2, of Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon. Their duration was from about 609, but it affected God's people in 606. So primarily the dates I'm going to use tonight, primarily, not always, primarily has to do with God's people and its effect upon them, not necessarily the time they arose. And of course it continued to 539. And then the bear, or Medo-Persia, comes on the scene. And Medo-Persia is the next empire and the next king pictured by the bear. Now we're going to talk quite a bit during our studies. In fact, not only in Daniel, but also in Revelation. Quite a bit about a beast that has 7 heads and 10 horns. Now there's been a lot of speculation about what that is. All kind of ideas are advanced. Some feel like this is going to have to do with a revival of some type of ancient power that's going to be emerge in the middle part of Germany and Europe, and it's going to be the Commonwealth nations. And there are all kind of ideas as to what this is going to be. Well, the Bible very plainly mentions it over and over and over again and tells us what it is, but again, it does it in symbolic language. But it mentions it so many times and has so many aspects of it that it's real simple to see what this 7-headed beast was and is, and the 10 horns that apply to it. Now, the first real good clue we have here is in the bear. You remember he mentioned here that the bear had 10 ribs in its teeth. Now, what would that mean to you? Now, the rest of them had that. This had 3 ribs. What did I say? Did I say 10? Excuse me again. Anyway, it had 3 ribs in its teeth. This has to do with the 7 heads of the beast. Now, the fact that it had 10 ribs means that something has been eaten. There's no flesh on them. They're consumed. That's how symbolic language is. This would not have been understood at all in Daniel's day. Could not have been understood before that day because these things hadn't occurred. Nobody could have put them together. But now Daniel is told, whether he understood it or not, I don't know. He's told that there were 3 ribs in the teeth of the bear. Now we know the bear, because of what chapter 2 told us, has to be Persia. The 7-headed beast has to do not with some creature that has really 7 heads and 10 horns. It doesn't have to do with some awful looking image that you see in some of the commentaries on Revelation and Daniel. It doesn't have to do with some type of a man who comes along on the scene and who's characteristic of these things. Simply, it talks about world kingdoms. That's all he's been talking about already, are world kingdoms. Come up from the earth and the sea. The first empire that affected God's people was Egypt. Now think for a moment. God's people were made an intact people. They were told when they went down into Egyptian slavery that in the 4th generation you will come out of this slavery and you will go into the promised land. Now, that was in 1711 B.C. Now, 215 years before that, God told Abraham that everywhere you look, I'll give you and your seed this land, but they're going to go into bondage and be there until the 4th generation. Then they will come out. And they did. 430 years after the promise, 215 years after the end of slavery, they came out of it to the promised land. Egypt was a nation that enslaved them. And every single nation that ever enslaved God's people, in this particular case, the Israelites, have met doom after they did. Egypt now kept control of God's people under 1496. At which time they came out, you remember, across the Red Sea, to Mount Sinai, and the law was given, and Israel emerged now as a nation. So this is the first head. The next head appeared in 721 when Assyria came down and conquered the northern ten tribes, which we mentioned on Sunday morning, and took them away from their homeland. This is the second empire that had to do with the affliction of God's people. Now the third empire was Babylon. They came in 587, conquered the southern two tribes, took them away for 70 years, and then Israel returned. The temple was built in 517, and they remained there an intact people until Christ came. How many nations have I mentioned thus far? Jim, how many? Three. Three ribs. How about that? You see, these are the three ribs in the bear's mouth, because the next beast, Medo-Persia, is the bear. Look on this chart over here. Do you see the third one is the bear? Fourth one's the bear. You have Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, and now Persia. So the fourth beast has in its mouth the three ribs of the empire ahead of it. And thus this shows us in sequential order that the kingdoms involved are first Egypt, Assyria, Babylon. All three of those have been consumed, and they're now in the mouth of Persia, which is a predomination now. So Persia takes over the limelight, the spotlight's on them, and the three ribs are in the mouth of Persia, or the bear, which it represents. You see, these things, little by little, begin to tie in together, and after a while, we're going to see God is painting for us a lovely picture that can be no mistake at all about it, because of these little bitty, tiny things he ties together, and be no doubt about it when you put them all together. So here we have the four heads of this great beast we're going to be reading about. The next head that comes along now is Greece. Greece emerged as a power to control Middle East where Israel was in 331. This is, of course, the fifth head. The sixth head arose on the scene in 168, and they conquered Greece. Thus, this is the sixth head of the seven-headed beast. Now, the seventh head comes on the scene. The sixth head has been on the scene, and it remains on the scene for quite some time, and we talk about it in Revelation. But eventually, the Bible tells us there's going to rise a seventh head, which is the papacy. Now, that's ahead of our discussion, and we won't talk in detail about that until we get into Revelation, except for tonight, a little later on. The papacy arises as the seventh head of this seven-headed beast. What we're going to find in Revelation, and this ties in with Daniel, is that there is a dragon who is the devil. Plainly says he's the devil. And of course you remember the serpent or the dragon in the Garden of Eden. Now the dragon is the source of evil and power behind all the evil going on. But he has in front of him an image that you don't really see the devil, but you see something else the devil is using. You know, sometimes people put a mask on. A mask may be something like the Lone Ranger, just a black mask, or it may be a complete facial coverage. You don't know who's behind it. Somebody is, you know who it is. Now, the devil is there operating, and he is active, and he's mean and corrupt and sinful, but the fact is, before him, you see something else. Now, he's putting the strings. He's making it work like a puppet. He's telling it where to move and what to do. The devil is a source of power, but this image in front is what the devil uses to afflict God's people and to harm the cause of Jesus Christ. Now, he has used this beast, which has now had seven heads, as a source of afflicting God's people throughout the ages. Now, in Revelation chapter 13 and chapter 17, we find that this beast has an eighth head. But the eighth head is of the seventh. And explains there that this is an outgrowth of the seventh head. And this occurred in 800 A.D. That's ahead of our story. But at least if you remember the eighth head, you'll understand that we have that to talk about later on. And that was the Holy Roman Empire, which emerged by Charlemagne's presence in 800, revived again in 962 in Otto the Great. Now, if you want to go to the library and get some history books out, I wish you would. Double check me on these things. You'll see that world history proves emphatically what Daniel knew and talked about back in 550 B.C. How did Daniel know all that? How in the world do you even think that Daniel could have imagined these things? He wasn't that smart. God Almighty told him what to write, and he wrote it. before these things ever occurred. Here then is what we're really talking about. But Daniel doesn't go in detail about all these things as Revelation does. Now the next head that under consideration was a leopard. This is Greece. Greece, he says here, had four wings of a fowl, if you go back up to verse 6. Now, I think this perhaps has some significance to it in that we have a bird that can fly. We have wings that apparently denote speed, if it denotes anything at all. And that's precisely what happened to Greece. You remember Alexander, who came on the scene when his father Philip was deposed or died. Alexander took the reins of government and quickly spread throughout the then known world, to the east all the way as far over as India. And he was a young man, even in all of the power and the swiftness and the glory that was his. And he compassed the entire world, conquered it, the known world, in 12 years. And then he could not have any more worlds to conquer. He turned because of his men becoming so homesick and rebellious, and probably would have rebelled to the point of dissolving his army. He saw that, so he turned around and came back toward the Middle East and back toward home. But as he was a very hard drinker and he was in a spell of being in that condition, he died in Babylon in 323 B.C. He was only 33 years old at that time. So Alexander here was a very swift conqueror, conquered the then known world in only 12 years, perhaps indicated by the use of the word wings here. But when Alexander died, so Daniel tells us here, this was going to be divided from one nation into four groups. Let's see if we can hear about now to verse 6 and see that. After this I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. So there we have four wings on this beast. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. Now, the number four there is important, because that tells us, before Alexander was ever even born or thought of, it tells us what was going to happen to his empire. When Alexander was laying on his deathbed, the question was asked him, "Who is going to succeed you?" Alexander had a brother who was not mentally competent, and that brother was murdered. He had two wives, and these wives had children, and they were murdered. So that when Alexander would have returned home, there would have been nothing left for him, but who knows had he lived. But he didn't live. You see, if his sons had lived, if his wives had lived and had other sons, even if his incompetent brother had lived, they would have stood in the way of somebody else taking his position. But they died. They were not there. The question was asked to him, "Who shall take over the government in your death?" Who do you think he appointed? Well, he was a young man. He hadn't matured yet. He was a man that probably didn't have the forethought that he would have had he been 65 or 70 years old and had seen much, much wisdom and experience, but he issued a challenge, and he said, "Who is able to have it?" What does that mean? Simply means that I've appointed nobody, and the one who can take my place will be the man who can earn it. So it's up for grabs, and that's exactly what happened. So, four of his generals, the empire was divided four ways. Seleucus, and you remember that name because we'll talk about him again, took control of Syria and Asia Minor and Mesopotamia. And then there was a second man, and his name was Antigonus, and he took control of Macedonia, which, of course, the northern part of Greece. He was defeated and killed at the Battle of Ispus there in 301 B.C. And in his death, two other men took his place and divided his territory between them. That was Lascamus and Cassina. And they took the area of Thrace and Bithynia and also of Macedonia and Greece. And then the third, but in this case the fourth, because the second, you see, died and was taken by the place of two. The fourth general now was Ptolemy. Now, for those of you making notes, that's P-T-O-L-E-M-Y. Ptolemy took control of Egypt. I think you can see now the extent of his territory. All the way from Greece in the west, throughout the entirety of the Middle East and the area you've been looking at in your television lately, all the way down to Egypt. So the entire eastern end of the Mediterranean Sea and area were controlled by these four generals. Now let me spell these words for you so you know. Seleucus is S-E-L-E-C, got it wrong, S-E-L-E-U-C-U-S, S-E-L-E-U-C-U-S. And then the next one you need to know is spelled L-I-S, sorry again, L-Y-S-I-M-A-C-H-U-S, L-Y-S-I-M-A-C-H-U-S. I've never learned to spell those words. Every time I have to look. The next one was Cassona, C-A-S-S-O-N-D-E-R. C-A-S-S-A-N-D-E-R. Did I say O? C-A-S-S-A-N-D-E-R. And then the fourth was Ptolemy, P-T-O-L-E-M-Y. Now these are the four generals to whom the Greek army fell, and it is these four that we look to maintain control of Greece and the Greek society until they're conquered by Rome in 168. Now later on, we won't see this tonight, but we will later on this week. We're going to see where two of these emerged as a predominant ones to look at, and it is these two that we have a great deal to look at in Daniel, because they constantly march back and forth over Palestine, over where God's people are, and trampled in the earth. And that's what our next study is going to be about. So here are the four that took over the reigns of Greece. Now the dreadful and terrible beast, which is under consideration, spoken of by Daniel here as being strong exceedingly, the strongest of any of these powers, and of course it's signified by the image of iron being stronger than, as you noticed last night, brass, silver, or gold. So now Rome arises on the scene, and Rome is the next world empire. Again, go to your libraries, and you'll notice that of the empires that have been world dominating, you have Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome. Just exactly that way. And that's exactly what Daniel tells us was going to be before it ever occurred. They had strong teeth of iron. They stamped the residue with the feet. And they were diverse from the beast before it, a much different kind of empire. And they also found that he had 10 horns. Now, we won't talk about those 10 horns tonight in detail because they're going to come up again. We'll have to take a closer look later on. But the 10 horns represent 10 divisions of empire into which Rome eventually had its power and sway, primarily in Central Europe. But that's in Revelation. Daniel, however, mentions it and tells us ahead of time these 10 horns are going to be important. And then he says there's another little horn which will emerge, and I suppose that's what we're going to have to look at more in detail. Verse 9 says, I beheld till the thrones were cast down, and the Ancient of Days did see it. Now, to me, that's a very pretty way of saying this, a very beautiful expression. The Ancient of Days. Who would that possibly be? Well, who's older than anybody else? Who has been here far beyond anybody else can dream of time? Of course, the one who made time, the Ancient of Days, would be Almighty God. You see, Almighty God is behind all this. Nothing's going on he doesn't know, not aware of. So now we have, all of a sudden, the picture of God Almighty controlling everything going on. He's allowing some things for the devil to get his hands into, but God's behind the scene. The Ancient of Days did see it. Now notice God and the description of him. His garment was white as snow, of course indicating the purity that whiteness of snow would. The hair of his head like pure wool. Here you see again the purity and also the age and the wisdom that comes with men who have white hair. All old men don't have it, do they? But God does. And pictured, of course, as ancient and wise. His throne was like a fiery flame, and his wheels as burning fire. Now, of course, the fire here is pictured not in the sense of something to be afraid of, but cleansing. As fire cleanses the impurities of minerals and forms the gold from ore and takes brass from ore, so God is pictured here as a burning fire. Now, verse 10 continues, a fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. Now, notice the next. The description, I think, is lovely. 1,000 thousands ministered unto him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. How many is that? They're just infinity. There is no telling how many angels God has. Can you imagine a being that has 1,000 thousands and does not limit that? And says 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. We have unlimited number of angels. God sent a few my way, and I'm thankful for it. He tells us that every one of us, as God's people, have angels around us who minister to us and care for us, because we are those who have inherited heaven. And God's concerned about us. And his angels are our ministers for good and righteousness. Every one of us who are a saint has God angels around us. And there's no limit to it. We can see the magnitude of God here in this description. And judgment was set, and the books were opened. I beheld then because of the voice of the great words which the horn spake. I beheld even till the beast was slain, his body destroyed and given to the burning flame. God is going to endure all the things of life. And at the end, when all these kingdoms and all things that are going to ever arise from that time forward that's evil and corrupt and harmful, when all those things are destroyed, God will still exist. And he'll be there, and it's his book by which they'll be judged. As concerning the rest of the beast, so now we've already spoken about the three that were minor in the sense of their reign and their power and their effect. But now the last one is the one that has given Daniel a great deal of wonder and concern about what's going to take place. Verse 23 tells us, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom. It'll be diverse from all kingdoms. It'll bring the whole world under its sway. Thus he said, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon earth, which shall be diverse from all kingdoms. I should stop there and say, when he talks about the fourth kingdom on earth, understand, he did not start his numbering back over here in Egypt. If he had done so, this would have been the sixth beast on earth. But he's talking about from Daniel's day, it'll be the fourth. So you see, one, two, three, four. So he's not telling us of the six now. He's already excluded the two which existed prior to Babylon. So since Daniel has been living and is living in the time of Babylon, he counts Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome. So perfectly ties in with the four beasts. So the fourth was going to be the fourth kingdom arose is what's under consideration now. It shall be diverse from all kingdoms. It's not like the others. It'll be different, as we'll see. And shall devour the whole earth. The whole then known civilized world will come under the sway of this forced empire, which history tells us, and the Bible very plainly describes for us, is Rome itself. But Rome, as we'll see, is approached from three different points of view. Now, you don't understand that yet, but you will later on in Revelation. But first of all, understand Rome. Just consider Rome, and then in a moment you'll see it explained. It shall tread it down and break it in pieces. So Rome's going to be predominant and control the world. The world's going to fall sway to its powers. But then 10 horns out of this kingdom are 10 kings that shall arise, and another shall rise after them. And he shall be diverse from the first, and he shall subdue 3 kings. This is a little difficult for Daniel to see, because he cannot for a moment visualize what's going to take place here, which did not occur until 533 A.D. So almost 1,000 years in the future is where verse 24 talks about. Rome came on the scene, and then Rome was defeated, but in its defeat there was left another head that would emerge in its place. Revelation tells us all about this in detail. It takes its place, and it becomes known as the papacy. The Rome of the Fathers, the Roman Catholic power. This arises in 533, and then the Roman Catholic powers arising in 533 in 800 has the 10 nations give military might and power and success to the papacy, so that the Pope now rules the then known world, not only from a spiritual point of view, but also from a secular military point of view. He has the entire Western world in his way. And they can't do a thing in the world about it. In just a moment, you're going to see how long he was to rule, because Daniel tells us about it very vividly. Now, the Pope is going to emerge from this 10-section area. He's going to take control of three of those 10 and emerge as this little horn who is to arise from the 10. Verse 25, he shall speak great words against the Most High, shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until a time, times, and dividing of times. Something's going to happen here, he says. There's several things he's going to do, and the time is going to be for times, time, times, and half a time. So it tells us here how long we're going to look for this to occur. But before we find out how long it was, he tells us some things he's going to do. He's going to speak words against the Most High. And that's precisely what happened. This has long been the idea and the desire and the aim and direction of the papacy. To be the one who would control the world, because he felt like he was the successor of Peter. And he felt like that he was the king of kings on this earth, and the entire world is subject to his control because he had been appointed by God to be the king of the world. Now, he's not always been recognized that way by all people. I never have. You haven't either, probably. But he has been by many, many people. However, Pope Pius IX issued the decree of papal infallibility, which simply means that when the Pope speaks about matters ecclesiastically, that he cannot be wrong. Whatever he says, from the point of view of his authority from heaven, he cannot make a mistake. This occurred in 1846 to 1878, and this is referred to as papal infallibility. Now, that's the position he held and had desired for many, many times before this, but finally it was officially culminated by him. He's going to speak words against the Most High. In fact, on June 20th, 1894, Pope Leo XIII said this. It's a matter of record, and I'll tell you where to find it. He said, "We hold upon the earth the place of God Almighty." Direct quotation from him. "We hold on the earth the place of God Almighty." Now, that's the position held by the Pope. It's what he believes now, where he feels that he has his position. Now, that's what Daniel's talking about. He spoke about that a long, long time ago before the Pope ever emerged, and that's what he's speaking of. Not only that, they claim to forgive sins, which no one can do but Christ and God. They profess to be superior to any other earthly king. But you know, Revelation speaks to us about a King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And John tells us that Jesus Christ. But our nation and the nations of the world in many, many areas have seen fit to submit to the mark of the beast by sending emissaries and ambassadors to the Vatican. Our nation has done that for decades, giving honor and acknowledgement and glory to the beast. However, we're going to find in Revelation that God is not going to put up with that for very long. But when it comes to a time for that to end, and when we find the time, times, and half time will have come, we'll see that the great domain over which he ruled at one time is going to be reduced to 108.7 acres, which is the very smallest independent nation in the entire world. The Bible very plainly tells us that was going to be his doom, and that occurred in 1870. We've seen him bite the dust, as the cowboy movies say. He's come to a bitter end as far as his glory and prestige and power is concerned, but he'll never leave this world until the end of the world comes. And when it does, Christ will destroy him with the presence of his coming. That's who we're talking about. That's the Vatican State today, 108.7 acres. But notice also it says here he's going to seek to change times and laws. He claims to have changed the Sabbath to Sunday. So that today we do not observe Saturday because the Pope changed it to Sunday. Therefore, we observe what we observe because he changed it. So he claims, and so the Seventh-day Adventist Church claims as well. The fact is, there's not a word of truth in it, and there's not a vestige of proof anywhere to be found about it. And the reason why is because Saturday, or Sabbath, was never changed to Sunday. It was abolished when Christ came on the scene and the Lord's Church was established. And thus, that's a claim he made, but it was not so. However, Pope Gregory the 13th is a man I want you to look at for just a moment, because something did happen here that proves that Daniel was talking about. In 1582, Pope Gregory the 13th changed October the 5th to October the 15th. Now, not only did he do that, but he was right in doing it, because we had made a mistake in or several mistakes in our calculations, so that the world was indeed 10 days off in accord with what the natural calendar is, the sun and the moon. And because of that, it needed to be changed, but the fact is, he changed it. And the Bible tells us that he would change times and laws. Not only that, but the calendar, which we have today, and go to your classroom teacher if you're in a public school and ask her what calendar we have, and chances are she'll know. And she'll tell you why we observe the Gregorian calendar. Now, where does the word Gregorian come from? From Gregory the 13th, Gregory the Great. And the reason why is because the Julian calendar, coming from Julius Caesar, was incorrect. It was good for its time and purposes and place, but it was incorrect in several points, and so Gregory authorized the change on it, and so we call our calendar today, based upon the Julian, we call it the Gregorian calendar. Look in the encyclopedia and find out about that. And thus we credit Pope Gregory with that change. Now Daniel said he seeks to change times and laws. Not only that, but back when I was a boy, I remember that every Friday in school, I could expect what in the lunchroom? One guess. Fish. Right. Every Friday we had fish. Now why? We were not Catholic. That is, most of us weren't. Because they had the parochial schools around, but there were a few Catholics there. Had fish. Every Friday I could expect it. Because we didn't want to offend the Catholic Church. And because it was their law that you could not eat red meat on Friday. Fish fine, but no red meat. That was the law. And so we knew that. And we accepted that. In fact, it even prevails now in many places. But the fact is, the Pope saw fit to change that. No longer is it necessary to eat red meat on Friday. Because on December the 5th, 1966, he changed that law and said, now you don't have to eat fish on Friday. You can eat red meat if you wish to. Now the fact is, he made the law that you can't do it. Now, he changed the law that you can do it. Now, which time he was right, I don't know. But the fact is, he made the changes. Daniel knew about it a long time ago. He'll seek to change times and laws. You see, some of these things would fit just about anybody. But to combine all of them together and tie it in with what we're going to find in Revelation, we'll be flabbergasted. Now, doubt that's another word that you probably hadn't heard before, like bellyache. And she says I use funny words out here. But you'll be plumb flabbergasted when you understand some of the other things going to tie together with it, because it's outstanding. Nobody in the world could fit this except one person, and that's the Pope of Rome. But we go a little farther. In this calendar change we have seen, the reason that it was necessary to make that change, and the reason we today are able to observe as closely as we can an exact calendar pictured in the heavens, is because it was discovered back in Gregory's time that not only is there more than 365 days in a year, and we think there's 365 and one-fourth days in a year, but we have simply found out later on that there is not quite just exactly that. It's different. We have found in the meantime that there is 365 days, 5 hours, 47 seconds, 47 minutes, and 48 seconds. So we've been able to find out even more closely exactly how many hours in the day, and we still had to change that 1 second not long ago. So we still can't capture God's count exactly. But Gregory's the one who did most of this and made the authorization for that to be done. We can go on and on. But I suppose that all kind of laws and changes that have been made and that are credited to the Pope would be sufficient for us to understand that Daniel knew exactly what he was talking about when he spoke about this man, this horn, which subdued the other horns and arose and emerged as the supreme horn of these ten. Continuing on, verse 26 says, "And the judgment shall sit." Now the judgment's going to sit, and we're going to be able to understand his fall, but before we do, we must understand that there was a time given for that to occur. And the time given here by Daniel was a time, times, and a half time. You remember back earlier in Daniel, when Nebuchadnezzar was to suffer seven times out in the dew and eat grass like an ox, Josephus tells us that a time was a year. Now, if a time was a year, and it was, and if we can understand this to be symbolic of something that ties in with some sort of historical event yet to occur, let's take Josephus' idea of a time, times, and half time. If a time is a year, that would be 360 days. You might say, "Now, wait a minute, I thought 365. Well, that's true. If we are looking at our modern laws, which tells us we have to have a truth in lending approach to loans. Ask your banker, he'll know what you're talking about there. But normally, throughout history, we have seen a 30-day month and 12 months in a year, which would be 360 days. Normally, that's the way loans used to be made, and that's the way that general account was made in times past. Now we have altered that in our present day. But considering that the way it has been throughout the history, let's allow 360 days to be a time. And times would be a plurality of whatever a time was, and so double that would be what? 720. But a half of a time, if time is 360, a half of that would be 180. Now, if we're correct, let's see how long we're talking about. 360, 720, and 180. Who's the mathematician here? You'll do. Oh, okay. 1,260 days. So, something has to do then, apparently, with some figure, some formula, some equation he was trying to point out to us, which amounts to 1,260 somethings, and we have already decided it's days if a time is a year. However, if we turn to the book of Ezekiel chapter 4 and read in that book, you'll notice there, in that chapter, you'll notice there that Ezekiel is told very plainly, and this is found, I think, a couple of times, but one of those I know is in verse 23. And there Ezekiel is told by God this, each day for a year. Ezekiel 4:16. He finally says, each day for a year. Now also, in Numbers 14:34, we find the children of Israel who went to spy out the land of promise. 12 of them did. 10 of them came back saying, "We are like grasshoppers in our sight. They are giants, so they are a beautiful place to inherit, but we can't do it." Caleb and Joshua said, "We can do it. Let's go over and possess the land. God gave it to us," and they wouldn't do it. God was so angry, he said, "You're going to waste away in this desert, and every last one of you from 20 years old on down, on up, are going to die in this desert. Every one of you is at Caleb and Joshua, and they'll get to see the promised land. And you'll suffer a year for a day. A year for a day." If that's the case then, we know we're talking about 360 days or day years, which would be 1,260 years. Now, if we're correct on what we're talking about, and night after night we're going to see some things to prove this, we started the papacy in 533, by Boniface I being appointed by the emperor in Constantinople as Lord Ecclesiae, Lord of the Church, 533. Add to that 1,260 years of his domination over Europe and the Catholic powers, anybody else he could control because he was King of Kings and Lord of Lords and Lord God on earth, so he thought. We come up to the year of 1793. Now you can put that back in your notebook and just forget about it if you want to for a while, but in just a little while we're going to come back and mention it five more times. Now, do you see how these things work together? Little bitty pieces here and yonder we're putting together. Daniel knew about it. John knew about it, but didn't know the whole picture. But you know the whole picture almost, because God has revealed all these little things that are fitting their places as time continues. So we're looking for 1,260 years of time from Daniel 7. And sometime after that, this time will be fulfilled, and we'll understand what it's all about. But verse 26 says, the judgment shall sit. They shall take away his dominion to consume and to destroy it unto the end. He has a duration of his power and his glory in his presence in such an awful way as he did control for 1,260 years. And then God's judgment will come upon him, as we will well see, because it's already occurred. The kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdom and of the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. The Lord's church is going to emerge again. That involves you and me and the fact that we now can gladly, thankfully, and with a great deal of proper kind of pride, say, I'm happy to be a member of the Lord's church. Without the oppression and the affliction and the mark of the beast that one time God's people had to go through with, I'm free from that now because that period has ended, and I enjoy his blessings today. Whose kingdom, he says, is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. If you look on the board to your right, you'll see that in the second listing, there is Christ's kingdom, which will be everlasting. God's kingdom is mentioned in chapter 2. And then we find that that kingdom, so Christ tells us, and Paul tells us, is the church of the Lord Jesus Christ. So you see, Daniel's talking about that kingdom which God would establish. And Daniel said in chapter 2, verse 44, it will never pass away, it will stand forever. And so it has. And so we are thankful to be a part of it, which exists today. The last verse. Hitherto is the end of the matter. This is all Daniel is told in chapter 7, and you've seen the picture. As for me, Daniel, my cognitions or my thoughts much troubled me, and my countenance changed in me, but I kept the matter in my heart. Daniel's saying that there was a lot about this I don't understand. I was troubled about what I was seeing, and naturally he would have been. Daniel was not able to see the marvelous truths you're able to see today. And the reason why is not because he didn't have the ability or the interest or concern or the spiritual pureness before God, but it just wasn't time for those things to be revealed in history as they're revealed to you today. You've been so kind to be here. I think we've talked, I don't know, an hour and 15 minutes at least. You've been so kind to sit and listen and take notes. I've seen almost no disinterest, if any at all. I don't think any. And I commend you for it. I do appreciate so much your being interested in these matters. It's important. And I think each night we're going to grow and prosper and learn so that by the time these 2 weeks are over, we're going to appreciate the Lord's church as never before. We're going to see our place in it, as we have tonight already, seeing just a bit of that through Daniel's writings. Again, thanks for being here. Just a joy to have you. May the Lord bless you as you return to your home. As we stand and sing this hymn, should there be some way we might render to you a spiritual service, it'd be our pleasure to have you let your wish be known as we stand and as we sing.